And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Nona Hendrix is an American vocalist, record producer, songwriter, musician, author, and actress. Hendrix is known for her work as a solo artist, as well as for being one-third of the trio LaBelle, who had a hit with Lady Marmalade. Her music has ranged from soul, funk, and R&B to hard rock, new wave, and new age. Her family's last name was originally spelled with an I. She is a cousin of American musician, legendary guitarist Jimi Hendrix. Nona Hendrix was born in Trenton, New Jersey, where she met fellow New Jersey native Sarah Dash. Later met Philadelphia-born singer Patricia Hult, Patti LaBelle. After a short-lived tenure as a member of the Del Capris, Hendrix and Dash formed a singing group with Hult, once the lead singer of a girl group in Philadelphia called the Ordettes. In 1961, Cindy Birdsong from Camden, New Jersey, became the fourth member of the group, who became the Bluebells and signed their first deal with Newton Records. After the release of their debut hit, 1962's I Sold My Heart to the Junk Man, their name altered again to Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. And Hendrix's husky alto voice differed from Dash's sharp soprano, LaBelle's mezzo-soprano, and Birdsong's second soprano. During this tenure, the group became known for their emotional live performances and their renditions of classic standards such as You'll Never Walk Alone, Over the Rainbow, and Danny Boy. The group often found themselves competing against girl groups such as the Chantels, Shirelles, and the Supremes. 1967, Hendrix, LaBelle, and Dash were shocked to discover that Birdsong had secretly joined the Supremes after Flo Ballard was ousted from the group by Motown. Different members of the group were in touch with Birdsong over the years. Birdsong's relationship with the Bluebells healed, and they came together again for the ceremony when the group won an R&B Foundation Lifetime Achievement Award in 1999. Back to the current release in question. Gary Lucas and Hendrix starred in a symphonic Captain Beefheart tribute with Amsterdam's famed 65-piece Metropole Orchestra at the Paradiso a few years ago. The album was co-produced by Gary and Jesse Krakowan, recorded at East Side Sound in New York City. The role of Captain Beefheart is being released by Knitting Factory Records on November 10th. The role of Captain Beefheart strikes a fine balance between the more bluesy and groove accessible songs and the good Captain's oeuvre and the more extreme, darker, and weirder side. Nona Hendrix is a longtime fierce admirer of Don Van Vliet music and possesses the huge voice and the commanding stage presence necessary to do full justice to repertoire that originally featured Beefheart's unforgettable multi-octave voice. Although she's best known as a funk soul great, thanks to her long tenure with international hitmakers LaBelle, as well as Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, as well as her own excellent R&B-rooted solo outings, she is no stranger to experimental rock territory, having been featured a guest vocalist with cutting-edge ensembles, including Talking Heads, Bill Laswell's Material, and Jerry Harrison's Casual Gods. To this day, Don Van Vliet remains a cult hero, relatively unknown in mainstream circles. If any album is able to change that, it's the world of Captain Beefheart. Please welcome singer, songwriter, record producer, musician, actress, and author, Nona Hendrix, to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Nona.
Hello, Ray. I think maybe I should just get born again and, like, have just a brief career. That's a lot.
It is a lot.
Even for me, who lived it.
Are you tired yet?
Yeah, I'm fairly exhausted, but I keep going.
It's amazing because you were there in the early '60s, you know,
yes.
Amongst all the hoopla, you know, the British invasion was coming. You had the Dick Clark era. I mean, it was awesome. That had to be a lot of fun.
Well, it was when they were deciding, you know, kind of figuring out what we were doing, you know. We weren't truly a full-fledged music business yet, you know. It was kind of like a record business. And then it became the music business, and then it became the music industry. And, you know, so we were in the days of trying to figure out, like, so what are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. But were the record companies hard on you guys to, you know, produce top 40 hits? I know there was a lot of shadiness going on back then. I talked to Tommy James of the Shondells, and you know his story, you know, with Levy, you know, and those guys. But what was it like? What was it like with the record companies in the day?
Well, it was different. I think more so for girl groups because we were, pretty much told what to do, what to sing, what to wear, you know, and most of the music, pretty much the business entirely, was controlled by men. And there was only really two women, Florence Greenberg, who had a label with the Shirelles, and Ruth Bowen, who was one of the early booking agents, an African-American woman. And then the others were, you know, like Carole King and songwriters in the Brill
right.
building. So, yes, they were in a factory mode and competing with each other, too, like with my friend Ellie Greenwich, who wrote The Do Run Run and songs like that, and great songwriters. So they were all competing to write songs, but as a girl group, you were pretty much, you know, this is the song, you're going to sing this, and the producers or the arrangers worked with you to produce the record, but you didn't have very much say, and you didn't write, really. I mean, there were very few artists, especially female writers and groups, who wrote their own material.
You know, it's amazing how now we've learned how important the wrecking crew was. You know, back in the day, you know, and so many of those songs were, you know, actually done by the Wrecking Crew on albums. You know,
yes,
they were,
it was really more of a, you were an artist, but you weren't really in control of your. What you created, your artistry. You know, where you had control was in the, you know, for us and for many other artists, was in your live performance.
It's, you know, then you had that Motown machine that came in, which was, you know, amazing. I guess Berry Gordon wasn't looking for any talent outside Detroit, or is that true, or he was more of a...
Well, there was so much there, you know.
Yeah,
you didn't really
true.
Have to look very far. And, you know, as it is, artists know other people who can sing or write, and they did have other people. I mean, just in terms of writers came from other places. Ashford and Simpson were not Detroit-based totally. A lot of the people who then worked, I mean, Parliament Funkadelic weren't all Detroit. They were called the Parliament, I think, when they were on Motown. And other artists came from other places who became a part of the Motown family, but they did have a tremendous wealth of, you know, artists to pull from. There were jazz musicians who became the Motown musicians, James Jamerson. They were musicians playing in the clubs in Detroit who became the Motown band. But they were primarily jazz musicians. So, you know, they're just, and Stax had their artists primarily from there, you know, from Memphis, and same thing in different places. I mean, that's kind of how it is, because people know people, and they say, like, hey, you can sing, or people are singing in clubs, or local artists are performing, and same thing with Philadelphia. you know, it blossoms if it takes off.
Philly has such a bit. Yeah, I'm originally from D.C., so I know all about the Philly scene and the Washington, D.C. scene. You know, of course, we inherited Marvin Gaye from D.C., Roberta Flack. You know, we got a lot of greats that came from
Howard University produced, you know, Donny Hathaway. And
that's right.
You had the go-go scene. I mean, you know, that's how it goes.
That's how it goes. Yeah, it's such a, you know, very influential R&B sector was Philadelphia and D.C. and New York, you know. You always mention Detroit, but they forget about us, you know, because...
No. We definitely, come on, Gamble and Huff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, are you kidding? you know, and everybody came to Philadelphia to be on Bandstand when it was Philadelphia.
Exactly.
And you had Jerry Blavitt, the Geeter with the Heater, who's one of the biggest DJs, and many other DJs who followed on WDAS and all those stations. And even in Baltimore, you know, had its, you know, Solomon Burke and people like that. The East Coast produced a lot of great music and influenced a lot of, especially the European artists.
I talked to Todd Rundgren a couple of weeks ago, another Philly guy.
Ah, yes, absolutely.
I could see you guys together because you know you love experimental stuff, you know, and he's kind of that kind of guy as well. I could see you guys collaborating on some music together.
Yeah, I love top music. I have for years, and in fact, I think we did a show together like years ago when at the Schaefer in Central Park with Ron Delster would book, you know, really good mixture of artists, and I think LaBelle we were on the show together.
Talking about D.C., you were just in D.C. You did a tribute to Hendrix, right? That is awesome.
Yes.
You were
amazing.
Yeah, Hendrix. I think he first appeared in D.C. at the Ambassador Theater at Adams Morgan, and this was in Wolf Trap, right? At the Wolf Trap, where you guys had the concert, and go ahead.
It was great. It was a great night. It was the second time we the configuration came together. Pretty much, we did a show at the Apollo is with Fishbone's band. You know, Fishbone are amazing. And so, again, it was Fishbone and an amazing singer called Liv Warfield, who's out with the guitar, what's the name, from Heart. They're out. They've made a record together, so they're out on the road. And she's got a big voice and a great personality and a great performer. And the young guitarist, Taz Niederauer, who is this brilliant little phenomenal 14 now, who just blazes on the guitar.
Wow. You know, I'm noticing a lot more of that on YouTube, a lot of young, you know, especially women that are really jamming with, and are unbelievable, you know, and they just pick it up so easy.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Well, you know, it's a different time now, you know, because they have... people are, you know, families are supportive and will buy you a guitar or buy you a bass or drum, you know. So, you know, when it was first starting, you know, in the beginning, somebody said, like, you know, in my family, or, you know, oh, I want to, you know, be a singer or go, it'd be like, are you out of your mind? You know, go to school, go to college, you know, get a real job.
I wanted to mention, too, at that Hendrix tribute, Ernie Isley was there, right? Of the Isley Brothers?
Ernie Isley, yes. I cannot say Ernie. I mean, that's he's the direct connection as well as myself with Jimmy, and he's just a brilliant guitarist. And you know, we talked about, you know, some really interesting times when they were working on different music, and they would say to him, like, okay, well, you play the bass, Jimmy's going to play guitar, and he was like, what? You want me to play bass with, you know? and it was just great to see him and to do that the show with him again. And we've reminisced about the days of the Isley Brothers and Hendrix and downtown scene in New York and New Jersey. So that was really and the audience was great. The audience kind of were on their feet from the moment the show started and until the end, and, you know, they knew the lyrics that I forgot, and it was amazing. It was really a beautiful night.
Yeah, you did a lot of cover tunes, Hendrix cover tunes that night, huh?
Yeah, some of the early stuff, Move Over and Let Me Dance, like an early song that he did with Little Richard. And,
right.
You know, a couple of the things that he, you know, did pre the getting together with Ginger Baker and other name just went out of my brain. So we were doing some of the more early rock and roll Chuck Berry influence, Little Richard influenced music, and some of the blues things that he did as well. And then we went into the All Along the Watchtower stuff, that everybody knows him for.
Yeah, I talked to Cindy Blackman Santana also recently. I've had a lot of interviews recently. And, of course, Santana just got together with the Isley Brothers to do an album. How awesome is that? I'd love to see that.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. That's got to be, just like music you want to eat or something,
Exactly.
you just give up eating and just, like, ingest
just
the music.
Just listen to music.
Brothers.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'd love to see the Isley Brothers back. Yeah, they're phenomenal. Just phenomenal band. Those guys are great.
Yeah, those shows, seeing people like that in, early days of their prime or, you are just, taken away to another world because the music is at such a high level. Their performance is at such a high level. They're just giving everything they can give in that moment and that time that you're in the concert. This is what we were able to see nearly every night of the week for years.
Yeah. I mean, top 40 radio back in the day in the 60s, I mean, there's nothing better, nothing better.
What was best was when FM came in.
Yeah.
And you really got to hear long-form music, and that was a whole other thing because you were, like, Top 40 was what it was, and it was powerful, but, to be able to hear, like, a whole album.
Exactly.
And really get into maybe some Led Zeppelin or, Yes. Yes, we're not going to be on Top 40, right?
Yep.
So,
roundabout.
Exactly. Later. Yeah. But, things like, or Genesis, like Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, that was only going to be on FM.
Mm-hmm.
It was great because you had both things. You had the Top 40 that was like pumping some of the, of course, the Rolling Stones hits and the Beatles and stuff like that. But then you had this FM thing that was going on that was also playing, especially on the African American stations. They were playing, Isaac Hayes.
Right.
Isaac Hayes didn't do anything under 8 minutes.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. So. It was a great time in music because you had that. It's not that it's not a great time now, but that was sort of again, things were being formed, and there was there were kind of in a way less rules or bumpers to keep you from going off the beaten path, and people would go off the beaten path, and you could find something. Find this amazing niche that would grow because you could.
You wouldn't have Captain Beefheart if it wasn't for FM and underground and college
Absolutely.
Music, college rock and all that, yeah.
Absolutely.
And Frank Zappa, another one.
Zappa,
Top 40.
Yeah, he was great. He was really big on Top 40, Frank.
Yeah. Well, he got close with apostrophe. got pretty close to that album. That was probably his most commercial, you know, album out there, which was a great album. I loved it. I talked to Jack Bruce about that album because he did some stuff on it.
Absolutely. I don't think he was really looking
to be
top 40 at all.
I love your taste in music, man. You know, it's eclectic. It's all over the place, which is great, you know.
I was introduced to, and I'm really, really, really happy about that, that, you know, from starting at like 16 and a half, you know, and when I did, I left before my last year of high school, and within, I'd say, a year and a half of that, we were in Europe and touring in Germany and England and, you know, France and other countries. So you were exposed to other cultures, other music, other possibilities. And even if you didn't know what it was, you could feel the difference in the vibe and how people were and what they listened to. And then, you know, meeting people who became friends and you stayed in touch, and then doing like the Murray DeKay show at the Brooklyn Fox on his holiday shows, with people like Tom Jones, the Zombies, Eric Clapton. I'm not Eric Clapton. Well, Eric was on one, but the Animals.
What, was Tom Jones trying to hit on you?
No. Yeah.
I could see that. That's why, because you were.
Yeah.
I mean, you were the best dresser, and you have the best styles I've ever seen in my life, man. You are so sharp. And you still are, and you still look great, you know.
Well, thank you. My thing is, like, if you have to wear clothes, they should be interesting.
Right. And the hairdo, you always change, you know. You always have a different style.
I think also, you know, I'm an entertainer, and you know, I should be entertaining. That's my profession, and you know, I have my pajama moments, and you know,
yeah, but even your pajamas is probably like a spacesuit or something, yeah.
Well, yeah, I have winged dogs on my pajamas.
Do you really?
Yeah, and the other ones I have like donuts and things.
You must have an incredible wardrobe, I'm telling you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like it. And, you know, I do. I just really feel like if I have to wear clothes, because I absolutely would prefer not to, but I would probably get arrested or something. So I look for the interesting to me. It may not be interesting to anybody else, but clothes that are interesting to me.
No, I think it's interesting to everybody.
Well, good.
I really do. Good.
I'll leave them to everybody.
You made headlines recently. So something you said. I don't know why they're making a big deal about it. About you and Bette Midler at a. That's where you first met her, at a gay bathhouse.
Oh yeah.
It's all over the internet recently. What? Why is that
Are
a big
kidding?
Deal?
I really. Hello. What year are we in?
What year are we in, exactly? I guess you did an interview mentioned that you, she's a good friend of yours.
Yes,
right?
She is. We weren't dating, so, I mean, that's not news.
Yeah, I
so
know.
We weren't at the gay bathhouse dating or nothing. So.
Right, you just kind of met there for the first time.
Well,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
what year is this?
This was, I think, 73, and... You know, I live on the Upper West Side in New York, and there's a large apartment building called the Ansonia.
Right.
And inside the Ansonia, there are these bathhouses. And at one time, you know, the gay men appropriated it. And it became a gay, pretty much, bathhouse. But, you know, of course, you have gay men in a bathhouse, you're going to have a show at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they started doing. I mean, Barry Manilow would play piano. You know, Bette would play there. Sarah Vaughan played there. You know, it was a real eclectic I forget his name. He did the song, If You Get Caught Between the Moon in New York City. Peter Allen.
Oh, Peter Allen. There. Okay, yeah. He wrote it.
And, you know, and we played there, and, you know, there was guys with, you know, the stage was, like, right in front of the skinny dipping pool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, guys would be in the skinny dipping pool with or without putting on a towel when they came out, and we'd be singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and and life was beautiful. And other things would be going on in other areas of the bathhouse.
Right. Huh. Are you sure that wasn't the Playboy Mansion?
No.
You probably went there, too. Not,
I did.
Yeah, I knew it.
I am equal opportunity employer.
Exactly. That's why I admire you so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, come on. I have one life to live.
That's right.
Right, that I know of.
Yep.
And I'm not going to scrimp on, you know, experiencing in life what, you know, without being dangerous and self-destructive, but to experience, you know, life is just this huge, amazing thing that I get to be a part of, and there's so much, and, you know, maybe I'd hold off a bit if I knew I had another life, but I don't at the moment, so I'm going to explore all these things, and yes, the Playboy Mansion was amazing. We performed at the Bunny Club here in New York as Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells.
Hmm.
You know, and I think it was a Chubby Checker. I can't remember who. But, you know, it was interesting seeing the bunnies walking around serving drinks while we were singing, you know, Oh Danny Boy or You Never Walk Alone or any of the standards we would sing.
Right.
And then, you know, going to the Playboy Mansion out there and, you know, Hugh Hefner knowing him, it's just, it kind of was a life of being open and showing up and enjoying, you know, the kind of the buffet that was before me.
I like that. The buffet that was before you. I like that.
Yes.
You know, the kids today think they're so hip. They had no clue what the 60s was all about, you know? They don't know.
Yeah.
You know? I remember, man, and the hot pants and the halter tops and, you know, they've got nothing on the 60s, you know? 60s was everything you know?
Well, I think that the difference is, you know, and because I was listening to some music the other night, and it was a variety of music, and the difference is that in the 60s and 70s and probably into the 80s and early 90s, you didn't have the sort of violent nature that's attached to some of the lyrics and some of the things that go on.
Yep.
You know, we were living on the edge. We were doing things that were, you know, our parents or whatever would think like, oh, no, don't do that.
Right.
And that the authorities would think were, you know, challenging or you shouldn't do. But there's, you know, some language that's used that I wouldn't appreciate anybody calling me today. It's kind of just like there and, you know, and sort of put out into the air. And so I think it's a lot, some of the, I don't know what it is. I don't want to say innocence because innocence is one thing, but some of the value of being creative is now it's just a shock thing, and it's like how shocking can you be without, you know, some sort of being of value to society.
Right,
That's the only way I can put it right now.
Exactly. The music back, you know, they were, you know, it was peace and love, number one. Yeah, I mean, you may have sung out about the Vietnam War or something, which I didn't blame them because it was a stupid war, but it wasn't kill cops and, you know, kill this guy, and, you know, it was peace and love. And everybody was we were all in unity back then, you know. I keep saying that, you know, people today think the 60s was all about, you know, race, hate, and this and that. That's bull crap, man. I had so many black friends back in the day, and we were all hip together. You know what I mean? They missed that, you know? And
yeah,
they really do miss that. I was even bused to a black school. I was the first one to get bused to a, it was wonderful. I had a great time.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry you did. You know, but I think the divide that was there and has been there was kind of kept apart, and we were moving forward and moving forward and moving forward.
Right.
And, you know, we, I guess, are kind of on the outer edges of America, and so, you know, we live in, you know, living in New York, you have got to get along with people.
Exactly.
You can't be on, you can't be like, you can't walk down the street, or you can't, you know, it's like, the city wouldn't function, first of all.
Right.
And, but then you have this great expanse, because I was just in North Dakota at a powwow, and, you know, what I went through going through security there, I never go through anywhere. And so people, you know, the security there, because, you know, they don't see people like me that often. And, you know, I forget that I'm black sometimes because I live in New York.
I don't see color at all.
you know what I mean? And so I don't expect people to treat me in a certain way. But then I got treated a certain way. And I was like, wow. And I was, you know, with Native Americans and doing this amazing United Tribes powwow. And... Mm-hmm. So you see, like, when you're in this great expanse of what America is, and people live 10 miles from each other, they get narrow-minded, I think, because they don't rub up against other people like we do in L.A. or New York or big cities where you have to live next door to each other and walk down the street or ride the subway or take the bus or, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they can harbor old, out of date, out of time, out of, you know, humanity, feelings and beliefs towards other people that other people can take and use and abuse, not only the people that they're abusing, but the people that they're using are being abused by these ideas and behaviors. And, you know, cause harm, and sometimes death, people lose their lives over some rhetoric that is, you know, that they've bought into believing.
It's very sad because, you know, things were going great, you know, in the 60s, 70s, when I was in high school, things were great. Nobody had a gun.
No.
You know, there were fights.
No.
You know, I had more trouble with these guys that were kind of rednecks.
Yes.
And they were they carried switchblades, and they had greased back hair.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are the guys I had.
Yes. Yeah,
and I had long hair. I had long hair.
You were a hippie.
I was.
Okay.
Of course.
But, you know, I think people really need to get things in perspective. If they recognize that, you know, if you look at the Earth from the spaceship that just stopped traveling that we sent out.
Right.
We're just
exactly.
a small blue dot.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're fairly insignificant.
True.
In the cosmos.
We are.
Right, so, you know, what are we fighting for?
Exactly. Like you said, life's too short, you know? You never know when your time's up. It'll be tomorrow.
Exactly, and the longer you live like I have, it really gets short.
So, yeah, I wish I could live like you.
well,
I wish I had your life.
That might cause you a few problems.
It's okay, I can deal with that.
Okay, all right. Good. I leave you me when I'm gone.
I guess we got to talk about the new album.
Yes, I'd love to.
The World of Captain Beefheart. It's going to be released November 10th, and you can pre-order that album now on Amazon.com.
Yes.
What intrigued you about Captain Beefheart? I was a big Zappa fan, but for some reason, I never really got into Captain Beefheart. I had a lot of friends that were really into him. I mean, you know, but what is it about him that you know, and why do people kind of see him as a cult hero?
Well, you know, Don Bentley, Captain Beefheart, is not music that you like casually get into.
Right.
Either you become a Beefheart fan, fanatic, or you don't. You know,
right.
Most people have an aversion to this music, most of it. And you know, through Zappa, he was introduced to a wider audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him perform at a club in the Village in, I think, like 73, somewhere in there, you know, and just was amazed at this, the music, because I had, the only other music I'd heard like that was like Sun Ra and more Yusef Lateef and jazz and, you know, more in that vein. So I was like, who is this? You know, what is this? Who is this? And then, you know, I think within that time also I became a Zappa fan and got to know Frank. And, you know, so I just loved how eclectic he was and lyrically what he wrote. You know, my first love in any form was poetry.
Right.
And from Shakespeare to E.E. Cummings to just about every kind of poetry, and prose. So, you know, Beefheart, I was really intrigued more from his lyrics of what he was saying, and
right.
and then also his voice, which was not, you know, like, you know, Frank Sinatra. You know, he had this really wild and manic voice and performance. So, you know, it's kind of like my clothes. I'm attracted to people like that. And I had been a fan ever since. And Trout Mask Replica was like, you know, my holy grail on Beefheart. And to get a chance, Jeff Krakow, the bass player with the World of Captain Beefheart band, was doing a tribute to Don. And in between that, I met someone I became friends with, and a whole group of people in the art world. And my friend Gordon Vanacosten was representing Don's paintings and his artwork.
Right.
And so we had a great, our friendship really became sealed around Captain Beefheart, because they just had an exhibition at his gallery of Don's drawings.
Yep.
So he was just this amazingly a creative artist, and I was attracted to his individual approach to what he did musically. He was inspired or informed by the blues, and I think somewhat R&B, and even some tinges of gospel, and then jazz. I mean, he kind of, in a way, I guess, like me, he's, you know, he took all these influences and made his own, you know, Beefheartism musical idiom. So that's, and then, you know, and then Gary Lucas invited me to do this performance of Beefheart music with this 60-piece Dutch orchestra with Co Calais.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, really? Of course. You know, a 60-piece orchestra is going to do Beefheart. That's got to be interesting.
I wish I heard that.
you can find some on YouTube. There's some excerpts
good.
On YouTube. And it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And we performed it at the Paradiso, which is kind of like one of the, it's like the Troubadour or something on the West Coast. It's that in Amsterdam. Everybody's played there. And it was amazing to do that. And then Gary said, well, you know, I have some friends who are like Beefheart, fanatics, and they want to do a show like out in Long Island in the Hamptons. Can you do that? I said, okay, yeah, do that. And then this guy said, hey, why don't you make a record? And Gary said, okay, let's think of do that. And I was like, yeah, I'd like to, make a recording of what it is that how we're interpreting Don's music.
I've had Gary on the show. he's a good mm-hmm. guy, really good guy. He was with Jan Close. He did a collaboration with Jan, and we were promoting yes. his Fleischer album, you know, the one with Popeye and all that kind of
yeah,
music.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Gary's eclectic, to say the least.
Yes, he is. And, of course, I think he was Captain Beefheart's manager, too, at one time, I think.
I guess. I think it was one of those relationships where, I don't know how you, symbiotic, I don't know how you explain it. It's, you kind of do everything and, you know, and hope you escape.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
I like the way you describe things. It's
yeah,
awesome.
he was one of those artists
yeah.
that mercurial.
Well, the album itself, I'm going to talk a little bit about the album. Some of my favorites, My Head Is My Only House Unless It Rains, which is from Clear
yes.
Spot, from the album Clear Spot. Great tune.
Yes.
Awesome tune.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love it. I love that song.
And another great track, a lot of cool slide in there, very old-time bluesy sound, was Sure Enough and Yes, I Do. And that's from
yes.
his famous Safe as Milk album. And
yes.
he did a couple of tracks from that Safe as Milk album. How difficult was it to pick the tracks, you know? I mean, for this album.
I think, you know, it was difficult because there are so many.
Yeah,
to choose from, but you know, Gary, having worked with them, had a really good sense of what an audience would be interested in, and some of that was boiled down when we did the orchestra mm-hmm. performance, and you know, so we were able to look at like what would really work and what would work really for me interpreting, Captain Beefheart's songs and. Adding my flavor to it, and that's how we sort of narrowed it down. And also the things for you know, Gary that he felt, because in the live performance we're going to do some other things, like Gary will do Evening Bell, and I will do Well Well, which is mm-hmm. really a poem by Captain Beefheart. And there's some other things that we do that are more even more eclectic than the ones that the what are called the mainstream Captain Beefheart. And so that's kind of how it was narrowed down, you know, the things like I'm Glad, you know, that
mm-hmm.
that would
that's
work
my favorite track,
for,
I'm Glad. I love I'm
yeah,
Glad, cause it's very soulful, traditional
yeah.
type of R&B song, you know. I love when
yeah.
you sing that like that.
And
a little
it's
bit
almost
Tina,
like a doo-wop
Tina Turner-like
song.
A little bit Tina Turner-like, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's got like this doo-wop kind of thing to it
right.
as well.
Right.
Saturday day. And that's very doo-wop.
Awesome.
You know?
Yeah.
All right.
Wow, you just took me back to the early 60s. I go, wow. That's great.
Yeah. But, you know, so there's, and there is a huge variety, which is
mm-hmm.
wonderful. So we selected things that were the different kind of flavors. Of Captain Beefheart, you know, Smithsonian Institute Blues, this whole other thing, and then When He Blows the Stacks, which is very menacing and the sexual
mm-hmm.
Connotation that you know is just like the you know hide all the women, hide all your women. You know,
yeah.
He's cold as a snake sleeping in the shade, you know. Those lyrics are just amazing.
Yeah, they are. Great guitar work on that. That's from the Spotlight Kid, that song.
Yep.
That track, yeah.
Yep.
It's a very incredible mix of Captain Beefheart tracks. You guys really put it together well. Great album.
Oh, well, good.
Really, really good album, good. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, we really wanted to, bring through us what it is that, Don did. I he probably would hate it, would be like, okay, good, you hate it, that's great.
Yeah, he was a tough character, wasn't he? Kind of.
Yeah,
he didn't,
of course.
Yeah.
So, that would be expected. If he loved it, it would be, maybe if he liked a couple of things, we'd be like, oh, great. But that's what we wanted to do. We just wanted to do the music that we love and share it with people.
You recorded this in New Orleans, right?
This was done in New York.
Oh, it was done in New York. Okay. For some reason,
yes,
I thought it was in New Orleans.
No.
You've done some teaser shows. Are you going to go on a real tour for the promoting the album, or what's happening next?
Yeah, I mean, we have some other ideas that we're looking at of where we would want to go and do. We're looking more kind of like a festival type of things, but definitely we'd love to play some clubs and be able to look people in the whites of their eyes as we do this.
Yeah.
And so we are working on organizing additional dates. Probably start more like on the East Coast and see if we can work our way over to the West Coast and look at Europe in the summer.
Oh, Europe, that'd be nice. Yeah, that'd be great.
A lot of amazing festivals that happen that would be Beefheart territory.
Exactly. I mean, I hate to say this, but nowadays, I think overseas, like even Amsterdam, Japan, those cities, they get it. They still get it, all the music legends. Some of the things we don't get over here, they're still very excited about that music.
Yeah.
That's
true.
A lot of guys, I've talked to guys from Golden Earring, from Amsterdam, and those guys won't play here anymore, Bands like that, Status Quo, they won't play here. Because they're so huge over there.
That's a problem because, what is missing is that, I guess in a sense like America's, like, what's that, so America eats its young? America just moves on and moves on to the next thing and in some ways doesn't, with the exception of the Grateful Dead, revere, some of the things, because, where I live across the street from the Beacon Theater. And I would go and, walk past and I'd hear Steely Dan in there because they're in there for, they'd be set up for, a week or 2 week or 10 day whatever run,
right.
And but you're not going to get that everywhere in America. You're going to get that in certain cities, and it's because I think we cater to a youth culture in terms of whatever the 14 to 20 something wants to be engaged by. Then that's what is kind of put out there. And also things that are kind of somewhat homogenized in the world. So I find that in other countries, their things are not everybody's looking for the homogenized fare. People are still looking for individuality,
right.
and appreciate you for that and not sort of knocking you because you're not like everybody else,
You just said it perfectly. Exactly. I got a new book out. It's coming out. I'm still looking for the publisher. Huh. It's going to be called Radio Kill the Rockstar. And, yeah, I was in radio also back in the late 70s. Yeah, I was a top 40 guy. But, you know, radio made the rock star, and he killed the rock star.
Yep.
I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. They homogenized, you know, and they're playing everything that deals with 13, 14-year-olds. You hear all this dance music, kind of dance music, which is, to me, a derivative of disco in a way, what they're playing. And, you know, if you have an oldie station, they're playing the same crap over and over again. You know?
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah. No, nobody's getting into anything different.
Yeah.
Which is very, very sad.
Because I work with, Berklee College of Music as an ambassador, I'm working with a lot of young people.
Right.
And, you know, part of my, mission there is, and it's more around, using electronics and computers and coding and stuff like that and how to move performance forward, which is important to me and to them. But what also is important is like, okay, great, you've got a laptop, you can DJ, but can you perform?
Can you perform?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you...
Exactly.
Can you move an audience the way the Isley Brothers did with your laptop?
Right. Right.
It is possible if you are engaged or mentored or challenged or pushed to do that, so you're not just like, putting something out there that doesn't really touch someone's heart, mind, or soul.
Exactly.
I spend a lot of time on that with the students I work with, and I'm working with two young guys called Soul Clap, who are highly influenced by P-Funk, and these are two young Jewish guys from Connecticut, right?
Really?
And they're all up in George Clinton, right? So
really,
it's you know, they're just like wild about the funk and how to engage that with, the electronics that they sound and stuff. And, they can tell you the snare on a track on a vinyl record from 1970-something that, they go, oh, that's a snare from blah, blah, blah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great young musicians out there. You know, they just don't get a chance, and they're not mentored, like you said. You know,
yeah,
they need help.
So they have to be with people who are supportive of them, hear their vision. You know, what we'll say to them, like that sucks, or that sounds great, and that they'll say to you, whatever my idea is, like that sucks, that's old.
Yeah.
Don't so. It's that kind of hybrid of youth seasoned performers who can come together and hopefully influence. I think people are doing that and doing it more now than they were in sort of the past sort of 5-10 years ago. I think it's the music business or the whole upheaval of it has begun to settle down, so people are now looking at musical ways to evolve music.
Yeah. We just need, they need an avenue to put it out. You know, they got U2, but, I think it still comes back to radio. You know, if you had some good people that owned stations that really cared about the music, that didn't give, that actually gave a damn about the music, and owned the station, then things will change. Mainstream.
I absolutely agree, and and I think you do see a lot more of that in outside of America, but I think that's why you hear this much more interesting music, and you see much more interesting performances of you would never get a Bjork out of America,
I like world music too. I get into a lot. I just found out I'm half Cuban. And my father's family was from Syria.
And oh, wow.
I grew up listening to...
Great mixture.
Led Zeppelin in my room, We had Celia Cruz with my mom, and Umm Kulthum, who was, you know, famous Egyptian singer,
yes,
in my dad's room.
So,
talk about electric. But I was listening to it was a Palestinian / Israeli band that did Umm Kulthum music, heavy metal. And I tell you, it's her lyrics, you know, it was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like experimenting like that and going out and finding stuff like that, because it was really cool.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, too, you know, as I was saying earlier about traveling at an early age and going to Germany and different countries and then going to Japan. You know, you met other artists, and what you found out was just music.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, you know, that I was from Trenton, New Jersey, and you were from Okinawa,
right?
Or you were from, you know, Budokan, or whatever, wherever you were from. It was like you loved each other's music, and so therefore you would, if you were on a show together, you would sometimes end up performing together or spending time together, and you know, I think that is one of the another issue in terms of being able to broaden the palate of Americans is that they need to travel more.
They do, not just
to Disneyland. You know, because the Japanese pagoda in Disneyland is not going to...
Yeah, Epcot.
Yeah, that is not good. That is not the same as going to Tokyo. Or, you know, or to Egypt, or, you know, so...
Right.
It's... So that in terms of, you know, like your background, what you know, bring to your, you know, your ears, your listening, your sensibilities.
I agree.
It's wonderful because it's not this, like, you know, four chord, you know, I love the Beatles, of course, you know, but it's not just the Beatles.
Yep.
Who had to go to India to find something new for themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they had to come to America to get the blues, to get, you know. So it's
It's just such a shame that we got so narrow-minded musically, you know, because it wasn't like that at all.
Well, you know, that happened when it became big business, and that narrow-minded.
Corporate America.
it became, you know, green instead of blues.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
It's all about the money.
Yeah, and so radio, you know, and, you know, Clear Channel happened, and, you know, all these things happened to consolidate. You know, we went through that whole
radio.
80s and 90s consolidation madness, and which is basically homogenizing everything to, you know, like if I can sell you a gazillion of them, right, we'll make a gazillion of them that look just alike.
Yep.
So that kind of happened. I think we somehow have, you know, things like rap really challenge that. But it's hard to challenge money, right?
Yeah, it's true. But I'm all about. I'm like you. I'm into the creative, the prodigies. You know, you don't even hear the guitar hero anymore. You know, out there.
Yeah.
You know, so many guitar heroes. Where are they today? All new guys.
I know. Yeah. I know. I mean, I think, hopefully, they're coming. You know, there's some young guns who are developing, at least over, that I know of over here in the East Coast. But, you know, there was a young kid I met in Europe. He's probably like 22 now. But this young kid was just an amazing guitarist, like this other young guy, Taz.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, you know, he didn't get to be, I guess, like a, you know, or maybe he is, maybe he's becoming that, you know, but I think people had time to develop. Like Eric Clapton didn't become Eric Clapton overnight.
Right.
Right. Or Jeff Beck didn't become Jeff Beck, who is my guitar god. Did not become Jeff Beck overnight. So, you know, it's the life and the time that they lived and had time to learn from other people and, you know, do all those shows and go on the road and not have any money and, you know, have people, you know, boo them for what they were doing. And play like the Ambassador Theater, like, you know, Jimmy did, and you know, 50 people in the audience.
Yeah, exactly. I saw Gil Scott-Heron at the Lisbon Auditorium in D.C., and they had like 20 people there.
Hey, yeah.
You know, when he started out, starting out, you know.
I played a club in Toronto, Canada, and it was the bartender and, you know, a couple of waitresses, my manager, and luckily the guy who wrote for the big music column in the newspapers, Toronto, whatever, and he gave me this great review.
That's an important thing, isn't it? You got that review.
Yes, you know, so good thing he was the other fifth person that was in the club.
You know, I did some research. You know, I'm a rocker, but I'm also a lover of R&B and Motown, you know.
Yeah.
And all those, you know, the Four Tops and the Temptations were definitely one of my favorites of all time. I got to meet the Temptations. Being in D.C., my dad had a retail electronics store on F Street in D.C., and I got to sell, I sold a pair of binoculars to Luther Ingram. And I love Luther Ingram. He was so cool, you know.
Yes,
he was so awesome.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Al Green played next door to us at a small club, and my dad had drinks with Al Green. I mean, you know, I love those guys. But I did the research,
wonderful.
You know, and a lot of those guys, like the Ohio Players, they're all gone. They died. A lot of people have passed away. I can't believe how many people have passed away from that time. It's really freaking me out.
It's true. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, a lot of those people were friends or contemporaries, just in terms of, and you know, having performed as much as we did, we, you know, most of those people, I met or did shows with, or you know, and yes, they are, you know, I'd say, gone or retired or in ill health, and you know,
very sad.
So it's but you know that it's time. You know, time. That's what time does. And
I know.
We're not going to live forever. I think the beautiful thing is that there's the music that we created, and we were able to share, and especially the live performances that we did, where we were able to really commune with people in tiny little spaces or gigantic spaces, and hopefully we can, you know, there will be the next generation will feel that way about their
heroes. I hope so.
Yeah.
One of my favorite performances, I got to say, was LaBelle on the Midnight Special. I mean, that was such an energetic performance. It was incredible, and it's still one of my, you know, it's all over YouTube. Do you still own that space costume?
Yes, I do.
You still have that, huh?
It's in
you were
storage,
the coolest girl, by the way. I always thought you were the coolest, the real cool one, you know.
Oh, thank you.
Of course, Patty was
trying to be cool.
You were very, very cool. Of course, Patty was badass, you know, the way she acted and everything.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. But and Sarah was, you know, very pretty, very pretty girl.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but that was a
time when you could, you know, for us, there had not been anything like us, you know, in terms of a group of women, which is what we were by that time, to, you know, wear outrageous. And then outrageous costuming or clothes, and then, you know, have this political infused lyrics and songs and social commentary and sexually charged lyrics, and perform in a, you know, not identical movement way. We were individual within our performance on stage, but together, and you know, and a lot of that was that our audience also allowed and wanted us to, in a sense, reflect them, and then they would reflect us.
You guys were pioneers. You're heroes to so many people back then. I mean, you touched so many people. The band, it was incredible. Great, fantastic band.
It was absolutely, you know, we were together for 17 years, so we basically grew up longer than most marriages, I say. And, you know, we basically finished our, you know, high school and together, and then had this amazing 17-year just always together nearly every day for all those years, and still are, you know, friends, and we'll be seeing each other on October 4th, and to get this award, they're giving us a plaque on the Philadelphia Walk of Fame.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations.
So, you know, that's going to be an amazing event for us. And, you know, it's great that we're all still here, all doing our different things.
That's right.
You know, have our careers and still challenging ourselves.
Any chance you guys are going to tour again?
I don't know. You know, we did one in this short tour in, I think, 2009, 10.
Yeah.
With the release of the Back to Now CD.
Right.
And, you know, I think if we did some sort of interesting new music, even if it's just the EP, I could see a reasoning for doing it. But I don't know whether, you know, what we did was just so, you know, of its time to try and recapture that and do it. I think if we did something different, and, you know, maybe just, you know, without doing all the fanfare, maybe just singing the song.
Right.
You know, and with a band, and maybe now and then, you know, an orchestra strings or something, but really just the, you know, because it was really much more about what we said and how we said it as opposed to the presentation. So that might be something that would be interesting for the three of us to do.
Yeah, 2018 World Tour LaBelle, sold out everywhere. There you go. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, and we really only like doing theater, so that could happen.
Yeah,
like theaters where you can actually, you know,
see the eyeballs.
Yeah, exactly. We like to look you in your eye when we're, you know,
congratulations on
skin.
Winds of Change with Peter Gabriel. I mean, that song will live on forever. That's an incredible tune. Was that actually a poem written by Winnie Mandela about her husband?
No.
Oh, it's not.
I read this book called that was
The internet gets it wrong.
No, it was a book called, because she couldn't, she was under arrest at the time that this book was written. So somebody interviewed her and was a ghostwriter of this book for her called A Part of My Soul Went With Him. And it's a really thin book about when Nelson was imprisoned. And it touched me so much. You know, I'm sitting at the same desk where I sat and read the book from cover to cover, that I got up and wrote this song called Winds of Change, and, you know, complete within like 30 minutes. And
wow, incredible.
I wanted to record it, and I wanted to work. I asked Peter, because I wanted Peter to sing on it with me, and he was in England at the time and was doing a new album. He said, okay, I can't come there, I can't do it, but send it to me, and I will, because, you know, I love Nelson Mandela. And I did, and he added his vocal and some other colors, and then at the end he played the African national anthem at the end, that is the part of the music that goes out. And it was me writing a tribute to, writing a love song from Winnie Mandela to Nelson Mandela.
Oh, it's beautiful. Just a beautiful song. Yeah. That'll live on forever.
I hope so.
Yeah. You know, when I worked in D.C. for years, I sold retail electronics. We had a family business. I could tell you, we were very big with the Africans, and I could tell you when an African walked in the store, I could tell you where he was from. Just by the way he talked, the way he looked, I could say, you know, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Kenya, you know? Yeah. We had a great rapport with all the Africans. They were incredible
great,
people.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's what I mean when people, you know, if you don't live in some sort of closed society, you get to know people, the good and the not so good, or the, you know, but you get to, you know, you don't live with this idea that another human being is, you know, kind of that different from you. Because we're all just human beings, really, in the end.
Yeah, that's true. So, I love other cultures. I love, you know, talking with people. We were like the United Nations there. We talked to, I mean, we had everybody. All the ambassadors came in. And I was friends with Dick Gregory, who just passed away.
Oh, great, yeah. But you see, that is one of the beautiful things about D.C., that, you know, when from a distance people look at D.C. as this sort of political nightmare, which
exactly,
is right
and it
now.
Wasn't. No, it was very international.
Yes, and it still is. Really,
it still is.
You know, I'm going there again to do something, and you know, it is an international city.
Yep.
The politics that is there, that is kind of what people see from a distance. It's just one small thing.
It is.
Portion of it. Real people live there.
I agree. You're exactly right. Well, I know we got to wrap up. I just wanted to mention one thing. Why haven't you sung a James Bond movie score yet? I mean, come on, you got the perfect voice. you know, like If Looks Could Kill, that's a great theme right there.
That's true.
Isn't it? You got the perfect voice for a James Bond score. So I'm going to mention that.
Good. You put it out there. I will put it out there now. You know, hey, Mr. James Bond, next movie.
That's right.
Call up Nona Hendricks for your for your vocal.
You'd be perfect. And he's making another one, so.
Okay. I'll put that out, the feelers out there into the universe.
Okay, good.
You know, I do believe that what's for you is for you.
No, I'll never forget this interview, because as we speak, my daughter-in-law is in labor, and she's going to have identical twin girls. So there you go. You got more women in the world. Two more women in the world.
Yay! Tell her, yes.
Two at one time.
Yes, I salute her.
she's ready for.
She's adding to the.
That's
the,
right.
The yeah. Well, what's the. The more sort of the feminine side of the world.
Well, you know, women are going to take over the world one day anyway, so it wouldn't surprise me.
True. I agree.
It's going to happen.
You know, if she wants to name them Nona and Ona, as my mother and her sister were, she could.
Okay. That would be great.
Nona and Nina.
Nona and Nina. I like that. That's awesome.
Any of those. But those are my suggestions, of course.
Okay.
Well, you need to go, because you need to go and be a newly minted grandfather.
That's right, my third grandchild, so I'm excited. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, just that everybody enjoy themselves, try to do the right thing, listen to some music every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put out good vibes into the
good
world,
vibes.
And and you know, and work to bring us together, and you know, live your life to the fullest.
The fullest
while you're
to
here.
The fullest, like you.
And get a wild and crazy outfit.
We can all take an example from Nona Hendricks. That's for sure.
Yes.
We should all get a wild and crazy outfit.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes.
Well, you're the hippest in the music industry, that's for sure. I've always thought so. So keep
thank
being
you
hip.
So much.
Thank you for all the great music, and we're looking forward to the release of The World of Captain Beefheart coming up in November.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Nona. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This is an absolute pleasure for me, and be well.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Watch for the release of The World of Captain Beefheart featuring Nona Hendricks and Gary Lucas on November 10th from Knitting Factory Records. And you can pre-order that now at Amazon.com. For more information about Nona Hendricks and concert dates, visit www.nonahendricks.com. Very special thanks to Howard Wolfling of Howlin' Wolf Media for arranging this interview with Kim with Nona Hendricks. He also set me up with Kim Simmons. That was yesterday. And to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget, purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition, Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com, and I promise you'll live it. Have a great week.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Station 1.